This is The Guardian.
Today, after the shocking killing of MP David Amiss, tributes and difficult questions in Westminster. At 12:02 on Friday afternoon, a Conservative MP for Southend West was hanging up a Zoom call in a church hall in Leigh-on-Sea in Essex. Sir David Amiss was getting ready for his regular MP surgery, where he was going to be meeting in person with his constituents. 3 minutes later, he was stabbed multiple times in front of his staff. Police and paramedics attempted to save him, but Amiss died at the scene.
I just want to bring an update to viewers who are just joining us that it has been confirmed that Sir David Amiss, the MP for Southend West, has died after a stabbing that happened while he was meeting constituents.
The suspected attacker was arrested. He'd made no attempt to flee. Police later said that a 25-year-old man was being held under the Terrorism Act.
He touched everybody's lives, and I don't know anybody that had that kind of reach. A truly dedicated soul.
People in the local community were shocked at the death of a well-liked MP who was a tireless campaigner throughout his long career for the seaside town of Southend.
I feel so sad. I don't know where we go from here. As a nation, I don't know where we go from here. I really feel sad.
In the House of Commons on Monday afternoon, the Prime Minister led tributes to Sir David.
This country needs people like Sir David. This House needs people like Sir David. And our politics needs people like Sir David. Dedicated, passionate, firm in his beliefs, but never anything less than respectful for those who thought differently.
And other MPs shared their memories of him.
We would see him late at night, often in a tuxedo, going from charitable concerns to charitable concerns, championing the causes he believed in. He looked good in a tuxedo.
Amiss's death, coming just 5 years after the murder of Labour MP Joe Cox, has stunned Westminster. It has also reignited questions around the safety of MPs in public and the potential dangers of radicalisation leading to deadly violence.
We will cherish his memory. We will celebrate his legacy. And we will never allow those who commit acts of evil to triumph over the democracy and the parliament that Sir David Amiss loved so much.
From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, will the killing of David Amiss change the way we do politics in Britain? Gabby Hinsliff, you're a Guardian columnist and former political editor of The Observer. We've been hearing tributes pour in from across politics for David Amiss. He was one of Parliament's longest-serving MPs, elected as Conservative MP in 1983 under Margaret Thatcher. What kind of politician was he?
He was a very gentle soul, David Amiss, and that, in a way, that's what makes all this so shocking. I mean, I first got to know him back in the late 1990s as a lobby reporter. I'm from Essex, and I'd got lots of fond memories of big nights out in a terrible, terrible nightclub in Southend, and that was it for David. Sort of Southend, which was his constituency, obviously was literally the world, so he loved anyone who had any stories to swap about it. But we've heard a lot of tales in recent days about his devotion to making Southend a city, but he was also devoted to the people. He was a kind, approachable, conscientious MP, and more fun than I've probably made him sound by saying that.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I was born a Catholic and I will die a Catholic.
He was a devout Catholic, which I think probably fed that sense of duty to his sort of flock, as it were. It put him on the right of the party on social issues. He had very traditional views on marriage and family, and he was anti-abortion. His faith also led, I think, to his interest in things like fuel poverty.
I've never met anyone who have explained to me in such a way that I can accept entirely that there is no God.
He was the sort of MP that we probably don't cover very often because they don't often make the news. You know, they're not fearsomely ambitious to get on, but they are often, those MPs are often the backbone of their parties and often of their local communities. And that was certainly true in his case.
For the 40 years he was in Parliament, he was never a minister and always a backbencher. Why was that?
Yeah, as you say, it was 40 years as a backbencher, and I don't think he ever harboured any ambitions to be anything else. I mean, lots of people come into politics, you know, convinced they could be prime minister tomorrow and find out the hard way that's not the case. But I don't think that's what he wanted. His staff have been reminiscing at the weekend about, there was one conversation where, you know, the whips rang up, as they always do, and said, you know, if you vote for this piece of legislation, oh, there might be a ministerial job in it for you. And he just laughed, you know, he wasn't interested in that and didn't aspire to that and certainly wasn't going to sort of climb over anyone else to get to that.
So what were the causes he championed? What did he achieve in politics?
Primarily, animal rights would have been the one that he was very most interested in. He was absolutely mad about animals, and he did campaign on issues like fox hunting. He did campaign on lots of animal welfare issues.
Part of the work of that should include issues such as puppy farm, puppy smuggling, and the unscrupulous selling of puppies and kittens by third parties, which are increasingly relevant with the sudden increase in demand for pets.
He ran the all-party group on endometriosis, which came as a sort of, you know, out of his constituency work. In a sense, a constituent came to him saying she'd had trouble getting treated, and he became very interested in that and took it up as a cause.
Sir David Amis.
Will my right honourable friend find time for a debate on the criteria for the creation of cities? Given that my right honourable friend once made a memorable visit to Southend, would he agree with me that it is absolutely ridiculous that the place is not already a city? Also, given that it is generally regarded as the finest seaside resort in the country, if not in the world.
He was obsessed with Southend being recognised as a city, and Southend being put on the map. That's what it meant to him, you know, that people wouldn't see it as this little town stuck in the middle of nowhere on the sea in Essex.
I did indeed make a memorable visit to Southend, so memorable I can actually remember it.
So there's a limit to what, you know, you can achieve as a backbench MP. It's very rare for backbench MPs to get to change legislation or get to sort of do something that makes a sort of grand difference, but they are often very good at awareness raising and pushing issues that government wouldn't otherwise have thought about. And that's where David Amis fitted in, really.
Well, last Friday, he was in his constituency of Southend doing his regular MP surgery, which is a big part of an MP's job. But for those unfamiliar with it, can you explain what it is and what exactly happens in an MP surgery?
Yeah, constituency work is sort of the unseen nine-tenths of the iceberg in an MP's life, really. It's the bit that never gets on the telly, but it's the bit that matters in lots of ways. You're part social worker, part campaigner, part councillor, part shoulder to cry on. And surgery is normally held on Fridays. The MP will take over a local building, a village hall or something. It was a church in this case. And any constituent can turn up and ask the MP to deal with their problems. So it could be something life or death, like you're about to be made homeless, or you're an immigrant about to be deported, or it could be that you've been badly let down by a public service, say a woman who's complained to the police about their ex-partner stalking them and the police aren't taking it seriously, or someone who's trying to get medical treatment and can't. Sometimes it's a complaint about something that's got absolutely nothing to do with the MP. You know, the council didn't collect your bins and your cross, and they've got to tactfully point out that's actually nothing to do with them. Most of all, it's how MPs find out how national policy is playing out on the ground. So it's like an early warning system. For example, I think at the moment, MPs are probably going to be hearing a lot of cases about long waits for NHS operations or people getting into debt because of universal credit cuts. So it's what makes policy real in some ways and throws up issues that MPs know they're then going to want to raise in Parliament. And when people say MPs are out of touch, actually, if they're doing their surgeries properly, that's not true. I always used to think as a lobby reporter, actually, MPs are in touch with a much wider range of people all week than I am, or than most people who are listening to this will be. And it's constituency surgeries that ensure that's the case.
Our main story. The man arrested by police following the killing of the Essex MP Sir David Amis has been named as Ali Harbi Ali.
How much do we know at this point about what happened last Friday?
There are limits, obviously, to what we can say at this point. It's an ongoing investigation. But what's been reported is the suspect currently being questioned by police. Ali Harbi Ali had made an appointment to see David, despite not living in the constituency. There are reports he'd told staff he'd recently moved in. And there were reportedly a group of constituents waiting at the church in Leigh-on-Sea in the constituency. And when David came down to collect his next appointment, he appears to have been stabbed multiple times and died at the scene.
25-year-old is being held under the Terrorism Act, and officers have until Friday to question him.
Last night, a candlelit vigil was held in tribute to Sir.
Gabby, what happened on Friday was incredibly shocking, but there is also a sense that it didn't just come out of nowhere.
Yes. I mean, obviously, what's very uppermost in everybody's minds is that it's obviously 5 years since the murder of the Labour MP, Joe Cox.
Just before 1 o'clock today, Joe Cox, MP for Batley and Spenborough, was attacked in Market Street, Birstall. I am now very sad to have to report that she has died as a result of her injuries.
But that wasn't, sadly, the only case. You know, there was another near-fatal stabbing of another Labour MP in his surgery, Stephen Timms, in 2010.
The former Treasury Minister, Stephen Timms, has been treated for stab wounds in an East London hospital. He was attacked during an advice surgery in his East Ham constituency. Police have arrested a 21-year-old woman in connection with the incident.
Before that, 2001, Nigel Jones, the Lib Dem MP for Cheltenham, was wounded and his assistant Andrew Pennington sadly killed by someone who, again, attacked at a surgery. It's not just MPs, it's their staff at risk. And we've also seen, obviously, more minor incidents, which were obviously terrifying for MPs involved. You know, Luciana Berger unable to come to a Labour body conference without personal security because of anti-Semitic threats against her. The list goes on and on and on and on. And there have been changes in the wake of some of those things, particularly Joe Cox's death. There was a parliamentary review of MPs' security after that. So they got a dedicated officer to deal with security concerns, and lots of MPs had extra security fitted at home, like panic buttons or extra locks and so on. For a while after that, West Yorkshire MPs at least were offered police and community support officers attending their surgeries and meetings to reassure not just the MPs, I think, but the constituents that they could come safely, because obviously this is frightening for constituents as well as for MPs. But most of all, I think what we've noticed over the last few years is a change in the way MPs themselves behave. They started reporting more threats. I think before, a lot of them had sort of comforted themselves with the idea that, oh, you know, these people don't mean it. They'll send a horrible letter or whatever, but they won't actually do anything. And there were more prosecutions as a result. But also, I've spoken to a lot of MPs who just changed the way they operated. You know, they stopped posting on social media about where they were going. They'd only post something after they'd been, so they didn't kind of give away their whereabouts. And that's where constituency surgeries are, of course, so risky. You know, MPs have to tell constituents where they're going to be, and that makes their movements very predictable in advance. And it's that predictability that worries security experts, because obviously it makes it much easier for someone who intends them harm to plan ahead.
It's been enormously difficult for MPs processing the last few days, both for losing a colleague and perhaps in fearing for their own safety as well. I've been speaking to a few about how they've been feeling, starting with MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington, Labour's Diane Abbott.
Do you feel more or less safe now as a politician than you have done in the last, well, since 87?
Oh, I definitely feel less safe. It's partly the level of anger and vitriol that you see online. And of course, you've seen the death of Joe Cox and now the death of Sir David Amess. I definitely feel less safe. I became an MP in 1987. And the vitriol we get in recent years has gotten much worse. It started in a way with the MP's expenses scandal. You saw a level of vitriol and a level of just anti-MP feeling that I'd never seen before. And it's got worse and worse. And then with Brexit, so much anger, so much venom. It's definitely all got worse in recent years.
Dawn Butler, Labour MP for Brent Central.
I have had a brick thrown through my constituency window. My constituency office has been broken into. I've had abusive calls at 3 o'clock in the morning, at 5 o'clock in the morning. Somebody has tried to attack me with a golf club in my constituency office. I was attacked on the train coming back from Westminster. That person got arrested and went to jail. And we've had to force several people out of my office who have tried to attack me.
And Tom Tugendhat, Conservative MP for Tunbridge and Morling.
I've always felt safe in Tunbridge and Edenbridge and West Morling, and I've always felt safe in constituency surgeries. But it's certainly true that, you know, the murder of Joe and now David have, you know, really brought home the fact that feeling safe isn't enough. You need to think very seriously about what's going on.
It feels terrible does feel terrible. Fortunately, my staff are very good at screening some of it, but it's very shocking for them. And I have young people coming into my office to work as volunteers or interns, and they are very frightened by it. And some of them have said to me they would think twice themselves about going into politics.
What do you make of calls to have police officers outside MP surgeries?
Despite all the abuse I receive online, I'd be very reluctant to have the police posted outside my surgery. Many of the people that come to see MPs with their problems have problems with the state. They may have immigration issues. It may just be something to do with the council, the housing and so on. But they would have reason to be wary of seeing the police outside my advice session. And I really wouldn't want to do anything that would deter my constituents from coming to see me.
There's a lot more that we need to do because it's quite clear that this is undermining our democracy and we need to defend ourselves as a community, not just as individuals.
Gabby, you've mentioned that things did change after Joe Cox's murder, but from what we've just heard there and from your own conversations with MPs, and I'm sure you've had loads over the years, have you got the sense that this affects how they do their job?
I think in some ways people have to become blasé in order to do the job. You know, I've spoken to a few MPs in recent days who would say you almost need to kind of put it out of your mind and tell you it's not going to happen to you. Otherwise, you'd kind of go mad thinking about it. And they'll often tell themselves, oh, well, other MPs have it worse, or that I'm not the main target, or that almost that it's become part of the job.
Shame on you! Shame on you!
I think it has become more personal for MPs. You know, it has become more intimidating, more in your face. And this is primarily since the Brexit referendum, but it's also, I think, affected by the climate in the Labour Party over the last 5-6 years. There's a sense that, you know, even if you're not a high profile MP, that you might be a target, and a sense that there will be physical intimidation, you know, protests on the protesters that gathered on the Green opposite Parliament during the whole sort of height of the Brexit thing. You know, it was quite a physically intimidating atmosphere to people to come through to on their way to work.
Your constituents voted to leave.
Why are you not doing that, Anna?
I've never experienced before. A few years ago, there were big protests outside Conservative Party conference, and people were, you know, spitting at people going in and shouting abuse and screaming. Anybody, doesn't matter who, doesn't matter if it was a politician, a journalist, you know, a waitress going in to run the cafe, you know, they were all running the gauntlet of this kind of hostility, which was new to British politics, really, but it's become almost like the background noise.
It does sound like at the level of social media, at least, there is just an epidemic of abuse of our politicians. As we record this, there is news that a man has been arrested after sending a death threat to the Labour MP, Chris Bryant. Is that something that was always there, but it didn't have an outlet in pre-internet days? Or is it just worse now?
I think people have always written pretty vituperative letters to MPs. And of course, you know, there have been a series of long-standing threats to high-profile figures from terrorism, whether that was the IRA or more recently Islamist terrorism, which means certain cabinet ministers always had police protection. But I think the difference is, firstly, that death threats are now much easier to make very directly and in numbers. You could literally do it on your phone while you're watching telly, you know. But also they've become normalised. I mean, the level of rage and vile and very aggressive, sort of personalised vitriol on social media, it's so high that I think it's just come to seem like a thing people do almost. And that's given people license to express something they may always have felt but wouldn't necessarily have dared say publicly or level it. It's not just politicians, it's anyone in public life or even vaguely passing through public life. But while it's really good and overdue, and I thank God that we're having a conversation about civility in public debate. I mean, I've been boring on about this for years. I couldn't be more in favour of kindness and tolerance and recognising that people you disagree with are human beings. You know, we did go through this after Joe Cox died, and I think many MPs would say there was a period of a week where people were really shaken and were nice to their MPs, and then very quickly lapsed back to being just as vicious as it had been before, if not more so.
Coming up, will this attack change the way our politicians work? Gabby, we spoke about the abuse that MPs receive on a daily basis.
Does the sheer level of it make it harder for the police to pick out the potentially more dangerous real-life threats?
I think it does, and it makes it harder for MPs as well to know which ones to take seriously and which ones not to take seriously. I mean, if you referred everything to police, literally the police wouldn't be able to do anything else 24/7. And that would be, you know, half the job of an MP's office. So it makes it harder to pick out the ones who are generally a threat. And that's where the sort of other half of the debate comes in, I think, which is about security and intelligence. It's not just about what online companies do to clean up debate. And we don't yet know exactly what motivated this murder, obviously, but we have here a suspect who we know was reported to Prevent apparently when he was still at school. It wasn't escalated up to become a figure of more serious concern, but it does, I think, lead to some serious questions. How many more people are there in similar circumstances, and what are they capable of? Are we geared up to cope with what police think may be an epidemic of young people having been radicalised in lockdown, which obviously was a very isolating time where a lot of unhappy people spent a great deal of time online disappearing down all sorts of rabbit holes? You know, it's good to hear the Home Secretary talking about online harms. Great, you know, let's take those more seriously. But I think there are also some questions she could and should be answering about Prevent too, whether it's properly resourced, whether we've solved this problem of how to de-radicalise someone once they're on that path, and also how you tell the difference between someone who may have come to the attention of the authorities but is never going to be a serious threat and someone who is going to go on to do potentially terrible things. And at the moment, we are treating this like an issue of civility and public debate, but I think it's more than that. It's also a serious security question.
As you've mentioned, the suspect who is in custody appears to have been previously referred to the government's anti-radicalisation programme Prevent. That programme has been under review for 2 years. Will it now see a serious overhaul?
There has been pressure for the government to come up with a revised counter-terrorism strategy, and not only to deal with Islamist terrorism, but also the rise of far-right terrorism. We've seen concerns recently over terrorism linked to incel ideologies and whether or not, you know, that some people with incel beliefs are being referred into Prevent. Are we geared up to cope with that? You know, I think there is a much broader question about radicalization and how we deal with people who have been radicalized and whether our systems for doing so are adequate. And I think, you know, let's wait and see where this investigation leads. But that question is not going to go away.
Do we just have to accept that the kinds of unrestricted access that we have to our elected officials is not sustainable? I mean, 2 MPs killed in 5 years just seems unthinkable in a democracy. Or does imposing restrictions on who can see MPs up close do worse damage to our democratic system?
It's a really difficult one. I mean, during lockdown, some MPs have done surgeries by Zoom because of the COVID risk, but that's obviously not sustainable in the long term. You know, what about older constituents, people who can't afford to be online, so on and so on? And also there's a certain, you know, there's an intimacy that comes from sitting down in a room with your MP. And a lot of the time, people who come to constituency surgeries, that's their last resort. You know, they are weepy, they are emotional, they are vulnerable and fragile, and they've tried everyone else and everyone's knocked them back. And to sort of sit there with a box, I don't know an MP who doesn't do a constituency surgery without a box of tissues to hand, you know, because people are often in tears. It's important to be able to sit down face to face with your MP for something like that. And I think this is ultimately something only MPs can decide in conjunction very much with their staff, who we have to say are also at risk in these situations. You know, the link to the constituency is what makes us a representative democracy, but also a reactive one that should be sensitive to the effects it has on ordinary people's lives.
We should, rightly, our elected representatives need to be able to go around with confidence that they are safe and secure in the work that they are doing. There are practical measures. There are many practical measures.
And I think probably the middle ground, and this is where, if I had to bet, we're going, is constituency surgeries carry on with enhanced security, maybe a police officer on the door, especially for the next few weeks when there will be a fear of copycat attacks. But even that has downsides. I mean, if you've come to see your MP because you want to complain about the police, do you feel comfortable doing that when there's a police officer on the door? You know, these are all really complex questions, but my hunch is it felt wrong and weird and obstructive when the barriers went in around the Houses of Parliament. It must have felt wrong. I don't know, I wasn't there at the time, but when Downing Street was gated off after the IRA mortar bombed it in John Major's time, you know, that must have felt very odd. And there was a big debate about whether that was distancing, you know, the seat of power from the people. But now it just seems mad that it wasn't done before, that, you know, anyone could just wander up and have their picture taken outside the door. So
And my suspicion is we are heading towards greater security, and that will feel very, very odd at first, but we will have to get used to it.
That was Gabby Hensliff. My thanks to her and to MPs Diane Abbott, Dawn Butler and Tom Tugendhat. You can find all of The Guardian's reporting on this story at theguardian.com, including the Prime Minister's announcement yesterday that in honour of Sir David Amess, Southend will finally be given city status. There's more too on our sister podcast Politics Weekly, and you can find that on Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for today. The producers on this episode were Sammy Kent and Alex Atack. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.